Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave. Welcome. First, thank you for your follow-up, the kind words, the questions. I appreciate that. It helps give me an idea of what you would like to hear more about or the kind of questions you have to incorporate that in the discussion. And I appreciate you sending me that, and I promise I'll wrap it into the discussion. And you already saw from our first seminar how that kind of contributed to me not sticking exactly to the outline. I hope that wasn't confusing. I'll probably do a little bit more of that, but not as radical as that. So we're going to talk today about some essentials for our work as coaches in decision neuroscience, and then talk about some applications about facilitating change and basics like how we can help someone succeed and deal with transformative success beyond where they may have imagined before or even have models for. So while we have open mic, any clarifications, additions, questions, anything you'd like to add or ask or add to the hopper at this point from anyone?
Nothing from me.
Okay. All right.
Am I the only one?
No, I mean, and I appreciate you guys taking care of the background noise by muting, because there are a large number of people on the call, and I appreciate your managing that so that we can have a discussion at the beginning and the end, and I'll reserve a bit of time at the end, more ideally than I did last time, for our discussion. So any questions or additions or just comments that you'd like to make before we move into our topic? Well, feel free to jot things down. I'll come back. And did I talk over somebody?
Nope.
Okay.
You did it.
Jot down anything, and we'll come back and have discussion if there are clarifications or questions or additional aspects. I mean, I know from the emails I'm getting that you guys are thinking about this, and I welcome even active input during our discussion time. But hold on. I'll put us on lecture mode, and we'll get going. Okay. Let's talk first about the psychology of decision-making. This is going to be a little more of an overview, and then we're going to have real practical implications, the third and fourth seminar. So consider these two scenarios as decision points. Linda and Janice have each been diagnosed with lung cancer. This is a prototype patient scenario that was given to many hundreds of people. And the framing is what I want to focus on here. For both, the diagnosis came at an early stage with treatment possibilities of radiation and surgery. Linda and Janice are both presented exactly the same two treatment options, but how they're presented affects the decision. Linda's doctor presented it in a positive framework. Now, I won't go into a whole lot of detail, but here's an example. Of 100 people having surgery, on average, 90 will survive the treatment, 68 will survive for 1 year, 34 will survive for 5 years. Of 100 people having radiation therapy, same number, looking at it in terms of the survival rate, immediate 1 year, 5 years. Janice's doctor put it in a negative framework. Of 100 people having surgery on average, 10 will die during treatment, 32 will die in a year, and 66 will die within 5 years. The same scenario for the survival rate of radiation. The only difference between the two presentations, word for word and percentage for percentage, to Linda and Janice was the way the information was framed. One in terms of mortality, how many people will die. The other in terms of survival, how many people will live. Across a large number of patients, with this simple positive and negative framework of options presented to Linda and Janice, 42% more patients chose the positive framework. The statistics were the same, only the framing was different. And this is an example of what we can think about, and I'll revisit this, what we can think about in terms of coaching. When we help a client engage in a positive framework in terms of possibility, it means that it engages a way of thinking and responding to create new scenarios or new ideas. It activates the brain to begin to think about things in a different way, about possibilities. If it's framed in terms of problems, it goes down the same pathway that already exists, even etches it further. So this is where, for example, when your client began, well, here's the problem. They've got that down. They don't need a coach for that. They've got the problem down really well. This is one of the reasons I ask every client, as I mentioned in the beginning, may I interrupt you if I feel that it might be helpful for both of us to look at something at the minute you say it. So this is where I'll interrupt. Even if it's in the beginning, I'm a little more hesitant before I have a working alliance, before the client knows absolutely for certain that I'm 100% invested in their success, and I know that they won't hear it in a pejorative or critical way. What's the possibility here? They've got the problem down. They're going to tell me that's what their social conversations are about. They'll get animated talking about the problems in the, what's the possibility? That's different. That means they're departing from where they already know, from that well-grooved pathway. So it's not really comfortable to think about something in a different way. We break the script from that default mode, as we touched on last time. So decisions then are made by combining the context of the framing with already experienced precedents, experiences that have preceded, and adjusted with feedback and results that follow. That's ideal. Decisions are informed by our prior experiences that inhabit an entire mindset, most often, that's activated by the framing. Without a comparable experience, though, a model internally may not exist. Our existing models can improve performance with a growth mindset, using feedback and results to adjust going forward. Yet, when no specific experience or model exists, a challenge can be there to generate new possibilities. We'll return to this later in this discussion. We make most of our decisions by using heuristics, mental shortcuts. These unconscious and automatic processes allow us to proceed, to respond to problems easily and efficiently. It's the default mode. We automatically respond. It makes it way easier. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. But many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way our mind and brain work. That's why we're doing this discussion here, to find ways that are consistent with how the brain and mind work, and collaborate with a client to co-create a new story. The fundamental principles that form the foundation of our thinking, feeling, and behaving are not exactly directly accessible, as we touched on last time. So we need an informed framework for us to ask the right questions, and I think an evidence-based system to use to optimize performance, to optimize the possibility of a very successful story by our clients. Now, insight can begin with reflecting on an experience prior to response. For example, the path to sustain and enhance a success may be really different than the one that originally created that success. So this is a consideration. The most recent contribution to this process systematically examines the random scatter of error and judgment. Nobel Prize-winning author Daniel Kahneman and colleagues described this in a recently released book, Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment. Here are just some simple examples that apply to us. We make different choices in different states of mind. We decide differently when we're calm, rested, well-fed, and alert. And that's different from when we're upset, tired, hungry, or bored. Another example. This is a random scatter of examples. Doctors are 15% more likely to order breast cancer screening for patients they see first thing in the morning than those just before lunch. 208 federal judges differed by an average of more than 3.5 years in the length of the prison sentences they recommended in the same 16 cases. So to avoid this noise and maybe even derailed or skewed thinking, consider some systematic discipline. Here are some things to think about. This is only to inform your listening. This is not something you're going to teach or train clients. This is to inform your listening and develop your own unique approach. First impressions can skew later judgment based on what we learned first that frames later judgment. Linda and Janice are examples of that. The framing determines the decision to a significant extent, far eclipsing facts. Another, determine the components of decisions to consider rather than a single quality that casts a halo or an impression above all others. Make a decision, look at something specifically, and yeah, we already have an association with that. It forecloses exploration. Get different opinions, different people answering the same question, maybe at different times, to enhance objectivity. So practically for us as coaching, consider these basic aspects to enhance objectivity of you with a client and the client with a decision. Pause to consider before actively deciding. That allows getting grounded and centered and not being in a reactive emotional state. We'll come back to that. Assess assumptions objectively, because assumptions are going to be based on prior experience. Does it fit here? Is there a prior experience that can inform? Look at the long-term impact. We're going to come back to that in a more systematic way. And then zoom out. Get a different perspective. Zoom out to consider a broad view rather than just the spotlight issue. So here's something to think about and consider. Decision-making can involve first, second, and third-order consequences. The first-order consequences, the immediate, the obvious, the intended result of doing something. The pleasure of eating cheesecake with strawberry topping, going to the beach or bar with friends after significant isolation. Second-order consequences track the outcome of the first-order decision. Our brain patterns favor first-order decision, because it involves the two basic motivations of our human psyche, to avoid pain or to seek pleasure. And it fits with the desire that our brain has to create closure, to end any dissonance or uncertainty, to make a decision. So to stay the course may be to pursue a greater gain. Second-order consequences require sustaining focus and work. Third-order consequences are the longer-term result of a decision, the structure of a system with stepwise goals that reinforce sustained effort to pursue a greater benefit. No, a very simple example. If you think about spending $100 today, if you're, let's say you're 58 years old and you wonder, if you put that in a retirement fund and it gained tax-free, what would that be worth at your age 79? A little over $800 at the usual rate of stock marketing. So think about that's an example of a third order consequence. Enjoy it now or think about what in today's dollars it would be worth then. So the goal, and we discuss it, the goal does not differentiate the winner from the loser. The system does. To focus only on the immediate first order consequence can lead to mistakes in decision making by ignoring the bigger picture. The first order decision may be challenging because it's based partly on our own biases. The automatic intuitive choice in our unconscious operating system uses already established algorithms. Attachment, behavior, emotion. The first order decision is obvious, easy, immediately reinforcing, but it may not consider subsequent implications by definition. Second and third order consequences represent a challenge specifically with a restraint of gratification of an immediate response and to consider natural consequences that may be less immediately rewarding. If you do not prepare, your performance will likely suffer. So the best judgments and choices consider all three levels in decision making, a strategic system to achieve and sustain success. And think about how with each of these, if it's applicable at the time, how you can convert this awareness into a question for the client. You know, have you considered alternatives? Have you considered not doing that? Whatever it is, think about how you can convert it into a question. So here's a question for us. How is self-awareness related to performance success? Well, one entire set of studies found that one quality trumps all others for great entrepreneurs, managers, leaders. I would include coaches, professionals there. Self-awareness. They found the most effective leaders improve their functioning by developing self-awareness to recognize their motivation and purpose to inform their decision-making, as well as, if it applies, their team. A reference here is the book, the very recent book, Heart, Smarts, Guts, and Look. So, some key ways to enhance self-awareness. And I think this is pretty much, I didn't stick much to the order of things, not to to get your attention, but just because I wanted to make it more of a discussion flow. Some key ways to enhance self-awareness. I think this is in the order in your outline. Have a framework for self-awareness, such as a way to get grounded and centered, to have access to all of your states of mind and all of the information in it, like maybe mindfulness meditation, just to focus on breathing. And a systematic way then also to reflect on strengths and weaknesses. And we're going to come to a macro system that is in your outline, the roadmap system. We'll get to that. And here's an example. In his Harvard Business Review article, Managing Oneself, Peter Drucker wrote, and this is a quote, "Whenever you make a decision, write down what you expect to happen. 9 to 12 months later, compare the results with what you expected." He uses the second question that we talked about last seminar for the coaching story. Where would you like to get to with this? This self-reflection process is a way to discover strengths and areas that need attention. There are a lot of successful people who follow similar practices. Warren Buffett, for example, writes down the reasons why he makes an investment decision to periodically look back to see what went right or wrong and to decide to stay or sell. Honest assessment and self-reflective processes create immense opportunity for self-assessment. Another aspect, and this is especially if you're working with others in a team, be aware of other strengths and weaknesses to enhance the collaborative potential. The question is, how do you create a working alliance, a collaborative alliance, and further that for that person's or that group's success? So let's look now at the roadmap system. It's simply an acronym for seven steps. It's not a formula, and it's not something you'd do with your clients necessarily, but it's simply a systematic way to approach and guide us in coaching others. We often make a decision by focusing on the content. What decision should I make? We may also consider the process, how should I go about deciding? Now, we see the world based on how we predict using our existing models that are encoded in our radar for what we perceive and process and decide. Our predictive models are sculpted from our prior experiences, and these prior experiences subsequently affect decision. So it's good to be aware of all this. This is also what we listen for, as we touched on last time, with our clients. If 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious, a lot of what you will be recognizing and collaborating with, the client may not necessarily be consciously aware of. Our predictive process is nested in an entire system of algorithms that comprises that 90 to 95% of our decision process that's not specifically conscious. So processed automatically and unconsciously in most instances, instantaneously, the derivative, the resulting emotions and behavior from this process, that's what becomes apparent and subject to scrutiny and change, even planning. So the roadmap system is a performance macro system for us to look at, to deconstruct and understand personal decisions and to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior. So the roadmap is an acronym for the seven steps to deconstruct and understand personally created stories and to strategically create new behavior. This is in your outline. The development of corresponding new identity, that last step, the P, program new identity, becomes the bedrock that allows this change and transformation to become permanent. So this is a decision neuroscience model to first understand our existing algorithms and then to systematically generate approaches to new situations, even where existing models, experience, and intuition may not apply. Now, again, I don't talk to clients like I talk to you guys. So this is a training, a recognition. We're looking at a system here. The application will be with your own signature for what, if you do, find important here. So the first step is to recognize and define the specific issue. Focus determines the initiation to systematically consider a specific decision process. What do you want to focus on? Recognize that you're creating everything that follows. Secondly, own your determination of the process and the system. We can talk about some examples of this. I also hadn't thought about this. I will send you guys a link to an ebook that has 32 roadmap case studies that was done by people who I've trained in various specialty certified programs, wellness, financial, and performance. And you can see, if you're interested, just pick out a couple and see what real life people, even including coaches who have been trained with me, do for a roadmap. It might be interesting. I'll send that around by tomorrow at least. There'll be a link that you can go to. The next step after recognizing and owning your story, to assess for a specific set of steps, a system that would indicate progress and successively approximate your destination. So we're still talking about the coaching story here, in a sense, a focus and a destination. This is in a broader perspective, though. But the assessment means you have a destination in mind. You don't know where you're going, any map will do. Decide each next step, the best action, the next best action to move toward that goal. Map the steps and strategies for progression toward that goal. The story of the strategic process becomes a structured system. The map allows you to measure progress as well as to determine, as we've talked before, what's detour and what's distraction. Author and analyze each step in this process. It's not there till you create it. Subjective and objective assessment can enhance insight and analysis effectiveness in this stepwise progression. The final step, program your identity to internalize the process as a working model of strategic thinking and action. Think about this as an important aspect of what you do with your clients. Each new step in a different direction is an abandonment of the script. It creates a dissonance because it's not what someone has done before. It's a step into the new and the unknown. So as you frame that dissonance as perhaps a signpost, or just recognize empathically that your client is going to experience some kind of discomfort, it's a step into the new and the unknown. If they read that discomfort as if my gut's telling me this is not the right thing, or my intuition is saying this is definitely not for me, that's a misread of that experience of doing something new and different that will, from what we know about mind and brain, create a discomfort because you've moved beyond the default mode and you don't know for sure what's going to happen. And when this change occurs, be aware of this with your client. Help them reframe each step as a framework of progress. The experience they have, I can understand that. That's exactly what we experience with something that's new and different. So the idea is to help them reframe it to stay with it. And here's the major aspect of this step. If you change something, you just do a different behavior, what's the natural consequence of that? You revert back to what you did before. But if you incorporate that behavior and metabolize it as into your operating system and revise that and transform your operating system as you do your behavior, that will make it permanent because that's the bedrock of your identity. We always return to our identity. That's what makes change permanent. Just like you can tell immediately what someone's native language is by tripping them. If someone gets in, they'll return to, unless there's this transformation that really is a hard work miracle. So let's look. So the effective decision then, in summary, begins with a plan, addresses how it's working, what needs to change, other options to consider. Here are the important components. There are only two. You don't need motivation. Have a plan and stick to it. So that's the question, if somebody is not proceeding and not doing or not getting where they want to, there are two questions. Do you have a plan? Do you have a system? Do you know what the next step is? Do you have a plan, and are you sticking to it? So let's look at decision models here. Now, here's a brief overview. We've talked about framework is a mental model to make sense of an issue and provide a structure of possibilities. A framework activates a particular mindset and the software program to process everything that follows. The frame even determines what's perceived and how it's processed, as well as the possibilities of solution. The simplest example, we touched on last time, if there is, let me put it a different way, your brain can't tell the difference between excitement and anxiety. Depends on how you frame it. If you frame it as anxiety, that makes sense. Better head recover. It makes sense to stop. Go to the mall or buy something good on Amazon. If you frame it as possibility, that's an entirely different mindset that processes things to look at creation of effectiveness and mastery step by step. So how you frame something determines the mindset you use to boot it up. Listen to this question. This is the title of a book of one of my favorite social psychologists and collaborators. Here's the question. Don't think of an elephant. Doesn't that determine what you cannot not think about? That's the title of one of his most recent books. So we search for what we already know and believe and filter out what disconfirms our existing beliefs and information. So here are some cautionary tales about framing. Be aware of your existing frame. You, as well as others in a group, may automatically assume a framework. Examine the point of reference and how that can determine a framework. Create, and an example there is to frame something as challenge, as opportunity. You begin to look for what's next. Different mindset than a problem going down the same pathway or danger, better head for cover. Create multiple frameworks or hypotheses to consider in making a decision. So for our client, this is sort of what I decided to do. Are there other things you've considered? What else? Now, at the extremes of really bad and really good experiences, emotion can instantly establish a framework that can process everything that follows. So an emotion, especially an emotional trigger, can trigger a mindset that already has the existing software and all the contents. It's a time capsule. Think about if you go home for Thanksgiving and immediately get upset with your sister. There's a whole number of things that already exist in that time capsule that will be booted up, that you'll be thinking about her and wondering what's the matter with you, that you can't, you're beyond a... There's an additional resource that I want to mention to you that is an example of what I'm talking about now and ways to look at understanding and managing emotional triggers, of regulating states of mind and managing emotion. It's a 35-minute webinar. It's a free webinar that I did and posted on my homepage of MentorPath. It's at the very, very bottom of the homepage. It's called Master States of Mind. And it's a webinar that if you have a chance to look at it or think it might be beneficial, it's free. and it's it addresses this very issue. So both conscious and unconscious systems interact in decision-making. So immediate decisions are immediately processed in our emotional system, the limbic system, the emotional intuitive part of the brain. Delayed decisions are processed ultimately in the prefrontal cortex with reasoned intellectual considering. These different neurobiological systems combine usually for a seamless process of decision-making. For example, decisions about delayed rewards will activate the prefrontal cortex to involve executive oversight functioning. So this, I think, is important as self-insight as well as information about what we decide. Task knowledge can be challenged not only by lack of experience, but also existing models that are already there that may not exactly be applicable. This is a little bit like outdated software. Subjective and objective assessment become sometimes equally elusive for a unique and unprecedented situation where neither knowledge or insight can inform. I want to come back to this and give a couple of examples. So here's a combination in decision-making of analysis and intuition. So this framework for consideration in decision-making can be applied by identifying bright spots. So here's the definition of a bright spot. I'll bet you do this in coaching, even though you haven't conceived of it in these terms, because bright spots is a construct of neuroscience. But the original sort of discovery of bright spots, a large medical clinic system on the West Coast that did family therapy with the most troubled families anywhere. They were an ultimate referral source. So they were having the usual struggles that people had, even with their expertise. They noticed one thing, that sometimes a family had an instance where the problems that they were all immersing, where the problems didn't occur. So they reframed that as the solution. So they began, and this was a bright spot. This was one spot where the problem didn't exist. So that being the solution, how do you recreate that? How do you expand and go with that? Because that's the positive framework that can be beneficial. We do that in coaching. We approach it in various ways. What's the most recent experience that you had where you really were pleased with the result of what you're describing now as a focus? Or looking at the last successful experience someone had in a related area. So bright spots become a novel potential solution to spark change. And they can even be more significant in novel situations that require unprecedented consideration when there's no option or playbook that someone has had before. I want to return to that. So to practically apply, let's consider three aspects of decision-making, decision processes, approaches, and questions. Now, these are in your outline. The decision processes, fundamental first, regulate state of mind, manage emotion, to be grounded and centered, to have access to all of this information in all states of mind. Clarify personal core ideals and needs. This is the compass, the purpose of someone, their North Star, what they need, their ideals that they live up to. And that's the only place I know that self-esteem comes from, is having internal ideals and living up to them. That's part of one's identity. Create a growth mindset for new models. And the principles of deliberate practice, we know this from the whole area of performance science. Look at a specific decision, focus on the next step, Engage a skilled mentor or coach or consultant to get additional external input, and then use feedback, subjective as well as objective. So decision approaches can be one or more of these. What was the last most successful experience beyond what you'd imagined? What personal tools did you rely on or create in that instance? What was the best practice you used? And importantly, and this is not a quick answer, who will you become in making the choices you consider? In other words, what impact on your identity will that be? So what I'd like you to do is, instead of me having you respond now, I'd like you to look at the outline and the decision question. There are 12 decision questions that I'd suggest you create an appointment with yourself of a period of time. This is important. So I'd say set aside 20 or 30 minutes. No pings, no electronic devices, no diversions. But set aside that 30 minutes. Get in a grounded and centered state and consider for yourself presently your answers to each of these 12 questions. So let's look a little bit now at, and I hear the commitments being made out there. I feel them. Okay, here are the uses and misuses of intuition. Hang with me with a couple of stories. Softball pitcher Jenny Finch was a gold medal winner in the 2004 Olympics. She challenged the best batters in professional baseball to hit her underhanded softball pitches. Her fastest pitch was 67 miles an hour. And as you probably know, baseball hitters hit pitches to 90 to 100 miles an hour, a way smaller ball. Although reluctant in the beginning, some outstanding hitters just could not resist taking her up on the challenge. Albert Pujols, the greatest hitter in the generation, was the first. Other outstanding hitters, Brian Giles, Mike Piazza, Barry Bonds, these were all championship players. Each struck out. In fact, only one hitter in the entire group that she pitched to, one hitter barely managed to touch one pitch for a small tip for a foul. They were humiliated. The best batters in the history of baseball could not hit a softball significantly bigger than the accustomed hardball, coming at them 30 miles an hour slower than their usual 90 to 100. Why? Same question, same why question, different context. Both grandmaster and novice chess players were shown an entire chessboard with different configurations of pieces. In 5 seconds, a grandmaster chess player could recreate from memory the entire board. A novice could only reproduce, on average, 50% of the chessboard configurations after viewing them for 15 minutes. Now, when both expert and novice players were given a random assortment of chess pieces, configurations that would never appear in a real game, experts and amateurs performed equally. They could not reproduce. Why? Same answer for both. There are no ingrained performance patterns in the brains of those who have not developed these mental representations in deliberate practice. Even if related patterns are well-honed, such as baseball and softball, there's no crossover. Expert baseball players could not predict the pattern of the ball as soon as they see the release from the pitcher's hand in softball. In baseball, they have 400 to 500 milliseconds, which is about half of a second, to decide whether or not to strike. So the pattern and position provide all the information they need to determine to swing at the ball or not, because the initiation of the swing has to begin right before, right just after, the instant before it leaves the, after it leaves the pitcher's hand. So the batters who faced Jenny Finch had no database of brain pattern development that was hardwired to create the mental representations and simulate responses. This is what intuition does. There was no instinct to rely on. Everything about the trajectory and the patterns, the softball, were different than the baseball, where they developed their expertise. And likewise, the grandmasters who could remember chunks, that's a neuroscience term, a whole segment of pattern configuration and instantly identify variations in the patterns they had encoded over deliberate practice time in their brain wiring. They could see familiar order and structure, but the novice didn't have this. It was randomness. So with sustained deliberate practice, you can reach and then extend your potential and your initial goal to make possible what wasn't even considered previously. So this kind of deliberate practice encodes an entire skill set to evolve into a mental representation, and these mental representations organize a performance sequence as well as solidifies an identity as performer. So this becomes permanent and automatic. So these chunks, these mental representations, when repeated, become hardwired in permanent memory. Now, intuition is a pattern recognition and synthesis based on past experiences. There are all kinds of mental representations, simulations that are developed at an unconscious level, then kicked up to the prefrontal cortex to make it conscious and logical. So intuition relies on these experiences. It's an attuned use of unconscious information to make better decisions, and access to that unconscious becomes crucial. So this is important. When you're grounded and centered, you have access to that unconscious intuitive recognition and pattern matching, and this can become automatic. It becomes automatic as coaches. A common example is the highly developed process of medical training for medical professionals, ranging from paramedics to physicians. All kinds of information, perceptual cues, systematic decision-making become part of the process of that expertise. Recognition and pattern matching becomes part of an unconscious intuitive process. Now, consider this question. How is AI like intuition, artificial intelligence? How is it like intuition? We'll come back to that in a minute. So here are some advantages and disadvantages of intuition. Decision-making process on a continuum, one continuum, of analysis versus intuition suggests, instead of either or, but both and, deliberate practice informs a seamless flow of thought and behavior, whether that's athletics, whether it's executive function, whether it's coaching, whether it's any other professional expertise. The mental representations and implicit knowledge become the algorithm patterns accessed in a seamless, conscious nanosecond. That's why you guys are listening to this right now, to inform and develop it. If this system's overridden by conscious thought, it can derail the performance flow mindset. Yogi Berra put it really simply. Can't hit and think at the same time. So that's why attunement to your client, the immersion in that process, is important. If you stop that flow and think about what you should ask next, that's a disruption of that. So refocus, just like you do on breathing. So another form of intuition occurs when some recognized set of experiences and expectations simply don't fit. This mismatch is an intuitive experience just as much as that based on prediction of an expected pattern. In both cases, the mental representations inform an intuitive simulation. So intuition is immediate and instinctive outside conscious and logical awareness, but it becomes an instantaneous sixth sense of an entire pattern that either flows or it doesn't quite fit right. So Intuition is not an inborn trait. With significant research on decision-making, we now know that intuition grows out of informed and developed experience. It involves unconscious recognition and pattern matching in a grounded, centered state of mind. This state allows full access to all the information in various states of mind in a fluid, simultaneous way. Now, this intuition also evolves and develops on the basis of our training and experience. This process can apply to performance, such as athletes and artists, as well as to specific tasks, such as medical, first responder, executive decision, and, of course, professional coaching. Intuition operates on autopilot, an instant and unconscious default mode. This automatic system decides immediately and doesn't require effort or cognitive energy. This adds to the inclination to make intuitive decisions or a go with your gut because it's easier and simpler and quicker. Conscious, deliberate decisions are intentional and considered by assessment, systematic planning, and review of results. So do you hear how it's both and? This intentional system involves conscious, logical reasoning processed ultimately by the prefrontal cortex. This intentional system becomes tiring and requires effort to sustain focus and concentration, which is why both you and the client would prefer you just simply make a suggestion. Now, they're not going to follow it, but it ends that cognitive dissonance and that energy that it takes to figure out stuff, to put it scientifically. A natural inclination is to foreclose this effort and energy and make a quick decision. An intuitive reaction using existing algorithms and operating models can mislead if they're based on an amalgam of past experiences and operations, which is the definition of the operating model of intuition. It's fluid and seamless, but it relies on existing algorithm, an existing system, just like baseball hitters who couldn't hit Jenny's pitch and couldn't exactly figure out why because they thought it was all the same deal anyhow. Artistic and creative endeavors, familiar processes and contexts, as well as practice performance, whether it's physical, intellectual, or interactional, are all areas that intuition can inform or mislead if it's entirely new and unprecedented. So, rote, systematic, other types of decisions, those requiring checklists and conformity to a structure, don't need even to access intuition. So, how is AI like intuition? Artificial intelligence, the ability of a computer system to perform duties and make decisions in informed ways, this traditional computer program follows strict pre-programmed patterns. AI can learn from existing data to make a choice based on new learning. Same with intuition. AI can also create through art and text and generate ideas and decisions not directly programmed. So could intuition. Both AI and intuition link experience and learned information with outcomes, maybe even in a new context, to predict good or bad results, favorable or unfavorable choices. Both AI and intuition involve unconscious learning that informs decision-making, and both are context-specific. Both can evolve with new information and discoveries to transform an operating system to generate blueprints. So, now, here's where it's important for both AI and intuition to use familiar context. This is five applications for intuition for us in mentor coaching to think about. Five applications from neuroscience that can suggest guidelines about using intuition in decisions. And this is based on some really interesting studies by neuroscientists researching intuition. There are five. I think this is in the outline. Don't trust intuition when you're feeling emotional. This hijacks that automatic processing decision. Two, learning, mastery, and experience are necessary prerequisites to use intuition. The novice chess players could not reconstruct. They had no working model of different schemas of position to inform a locking in with memory. Three, don't mistake impulsive desires for intuitive insights. They come just as quickly. Four, intuition may not be useful for probability judgments because that involves intellectual assessment and a different model. And five, and this kind of covers all of the above in a way, use intuition only in familiar and predictable contexts. So, just as AI requires input and learning systems, intuition also reflects intuition reflects input and learning systems. If a part of that learning, for either one, if part of that input or learning contains, for example, a gender or racial or ethnic bias, intuition will incorporate that in the automatic intuitive process. And for both, software may be outdated. So I'm going to go to discussion mode for questions, comments. So what do you think? Any clarifications or questions or different ideas? What would be most helpful in these, hope for more minutes, in the last two or three minutes to discuss?
Dave, hi, it's Mike.
Oh, hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Thanks for all your comments off the record by email. I appreciate it and very impressive.
Well,
go ahead.
I have a kind of a separate question here, and it relates to this notion of intuition. It's about this so-called Pygmalion effect, you know, the effect that leaders and authority figures have on outcomes, good or bad, specifically expectations. So, for example, you used the medical example at the beginning, where two women had two different approaches, one slightly more positive, one slightly more negative. And, this kind of Pygmalion effect is, you know, the expectation of the authority figure, whether it's a doctor, whether it's a teacher, whether it's us as coaches or athletic, coaches, what they expect of their prodigy or their protege is apt to kind of swamp their instinct. You know, what's the impact of that? How can we help overcome that? And what is all that trigger within us where these outside influences, you know, may actually swamp our identity and impose what other people expect from us?
Okay, I want to really respond to your question. I want to ask you to focus on the aspect of that you'd like to ask and frame it in a clear, brief, simple, specific way as a beginning, and that may be all we have time for, but what specifically is the question you'd like us to address that might be of hopeful benefit to us?
How can these, you know, toxic authority figures affect our instincts to produce negative outcomes, if that's what, they expect, or perhaps more positive outcomes, if that's what they expect.
So the framework
the
that you're asking that from, I'm going to interrupt you, Mike, for time. The framework you're asking from is you're doing mentor coaching with an executive, and you're seeing that executive have a toxic effect. So if that's a capture of that, what's the specific question as a next discussion focus for just a half a minute?
You know, how do we...
that's not accurate, reframe it, but I just need succinctness.
Yeah, it is. I guess it's kind of a complex question for a minute and a half. You know, we could probably go on for hours with it, but, you know, the outside influence of people's expectations of us can affect our performance and our outcome. You know, how does that affect our internal instincts, and what can we do to help our clients overcome that?
Okay, so, and this is an application of what we just talked about. Whenever there's a consideration, as you just heard Mike offer, the framework is the beginning, because that determines exactly what you're focusing on. I wanted to be sure he and I were focusing on the same thing. So I hear two different levels and two frameworks, and I want to just offer a brief response to each framework. If the framework is the effect of the person and the effect of the person on, you know, colleagues, the board of directors, neuroscientists call that the halo effect, that someone has an effect on someone where they're more likely to see the positive, to agree with, or be afraid to not agree with. That establishes the framework for somebody who is in the orbit of that person, that they're more likely to idealize or see the halo effect, and that frames their response to that person. So that can skew things. Now, from the perspective of mentor coaching, that person is your client. So here, I believe, the challenge, the initial challenge would be to develop a working alliance with that person so that that person knows that beyond a doubt you are invested and taking the position of being an optimum benefit to that person. You're not being judgmental, pejorative, or critical. What that means is that you can get away with saying what you need to after you've developed that working alliance to help that person. When that person knows you're invested totally in their better performance or their success or whatever it is, that you can collaboratively look at that and find a way to mutually examine that. That's where the collaborative framework of coaching is so important. So that's the framework of mentor coaching, the collaboration that you develop to look at it together. And you probably heard me, you know, say this as a beginning of the empathic resonance with somebody, to know their experience first. And I know we're over time, but I want to offer it as the best supervision I've ever had about how to begin doing this. I offered an interpretation to an analytic patient many years ago before I moved to mentor coaching. An executive woman, I offered something that I thought was going to be really helpful, and she paused. And I knew something was going on. She finally got up on one elbow, looked back at me in my analytic chair, and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." So that's the challenge with this person that Mike talked about. You have to be with him. You have to collaboratively create a framework so that both of you get curious together. And that means that it's okay if you interrupt each other. You're both going to the same place. You're not trying to do anything for you. You are 100% invested in that person's success moment by moment and step by step. And that allows you both to do the things that are necessary. And that framework is within confidentiality and collaboration, which is why even with an executive, I would want that absolutely and not reporting to anybody. So thank you for that, Maya. I hope that begins an answer, and I hope that's useful for each of you. We'll pick up right here next time, and any of you feel free to send me an email with different points of view or anything, clarifications, anything you'd like to have wrapped into the discussion. Thanks so much for all of your input, energy, and thanks again, Mike. I appreciate it. See you guys next week, same time. Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely.